The Gifted Season 1, Episode 1, Exposed, is over, but we're just getting started exposing, not ourselves, but exposing the secrets of the X-Men as they have come to television here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everybody. I am Josh Wigler, and in the blink of an eye, you will hear him yourself, our expert, that is without an E in front of expert, our expert for today's podcast, the great John Reed. John Reed, how are you doing, man?
I'm great. I feel like a mutant that has been moved from a fabulous mansion into a torn down hotel somewhere in New York, LA. I don't even know where they are at this point, but
I think they're in Atlanta.
Oh, yes, Atlanta. Right.
You know, one of those rare occasions where they are actually shooting in Atlanta and calling it Atlanta. You know, I appreciate that.
Yes, it makes sense. I think that that's probably a good idea. They don't need to be in New York for this one, I guess, as most Marvel shows are. But yes, it's a good thing that they're able to use the city and actually call it the city it is.
All right, so we're not going to be talking about Atlanta purely for the history of this podcast. That would be a different podcast. The Atlanta podcast,
ATL podcast,
it has not been birthed yet here on Post Show Recaps. Perhaps someday in the future. So just to set up what we are doing here today, if you haven't heard yet, there's a new TV show in town called The Gifted. It is rooted in the X-Men from Marvel Comics, which, you know, unless you're, I don't know how you would have missed X-Men as a concept. Like, if you've made it this far and you are capable of listening to podcasts, but you've never heard the words X-Men before, I'm shocked.
That's my darkest timeline, Josh. It's my darkest timeline.
That would be darker than the Days of Future Past timeline.
Oh, yeah.
Even the Age of Apocalypse timeline might be more appropriate to discuss here.
That's my favorite timeline, that one.
Yeah, that's the best timeline. But we're talking about The Gifted, which is a TV show on Fox that is based in the X-Men. It does not feature the X-Men. It features characters from X-Men. It is certainly heavily steeped in mutant mythology, and it's interesting. I liked it, and I wasn't planning on podcasting about it. I'm doing some light coverage of the show for The Hollywood Reporter over at my day job. I got to interview the showrunner of this new series, Matt Nix, who had some interesting things to say on the subject. But John Reed, you knocked on my door. You are a superhero super fan and an X-Man super fan in particular. Of course, the host or one of the hosts of the Nerdrotic podcast, which I believe you've already talked about The Gifted at this point. So you must just be really super into The Gifted at this point that you want to talk about it again.
I'm super into The Gifted. Yes, we did a deep dive last night. I'm a huge X-Men fan. Of all the things that I geek out about, the X-Men is the one I probably hold the most dear, all the way, you know, going all the way back to the 90s cartoon, which got me into comics in the first place. I've got an Iceman tattoo on my arm. I'm a super fan, especially of a couple of these characters we get in The Gifted. And I really thought this show was going to be something that didn't give us a whole lot of real X-Men. But the fact that we got Polaris and Blink and Thunderbird, like, they did a pretty good job of mining some great, you know, B characters that they're elevating in this show. So, you know, of everything that I care about deeply, the X-Men is probably at the top of that list.
A banner week for John Reed and Post Show Recaps. You were also the co-host on the Star Trek Discovery podcast this week. How's Star Trek Discovery? I haven't imbibed yet. I haven't beamed up. I haven't engaged.
So Star Trek Discovery is one of those things that's probably at the lowest point. You know, Star Trek is probably one of the lowest things on the things I geek out about and care about the most. So I'm actually enjoying it because I don't care about all the changes they're making. And, like, viscerally, story-wise, it's fun. It's a good show. It reminds me a lot of Battlestar Galactica, a lot of The Expanse. So I'm digging the last couple episodes. Have set it on an interesting track that I'm on board. I'm on board the Discovery.
All right, so get us on board for The Gifted here, John. This is your show. This is your time. I really liked this episode, and I'm not going to require much convincing. But, you know, for the people who think that first of all, it's totally true. There's way too many shows on TV right now. There's just way too much out there. It's impossible to watch everything, even if it's literally your job. It is not possible. I can promise you that. But on top of that, if you're refining it even further, there's a lot of superheroes TV as well. There's a lot of shows that are based on comic books or, you know, invented superhero characters. The DC universe is really thriving on the CW, for instance. The Marvel shows are kind of all over the place, both in terms of where they are being hosted, whether it's Netflix or ABC or now even Fox, but also they're not even necessarily in the same universes as each other. So where do we even start as we are approaching something that just on the surface would seem so daunting in approaching The Gifted?
So first of all, I think that with superhero TV shows and comic book related TV shows, I think we're at like 50%. I think we're not powered up. Just like Blink, we're getting used to the idea, but we're not quite, you know, we're not quite there yet. I think the spring we're about to get a bunch of Freeform Marvel shows, Runaways coming out on Hulu. You know, I think we're getting to the point where we're at full saturation, but we're not quite there yet. And I think what's interesting about The Gifted spot in all of that is it's kind of setting a new bar for what the like typical TV superhero show should be. I think that the standard before was The Flash. I think The Flash came out on CW and was one of those shows that anyone who was into those types of comic books and superheroes was able to get into because they were throwing a lot of powers at you. They were throwing a lot of characters at you and it was really fun. I think what The Gifted has done is refined that and made that a little bit more palatable maybe for an older audience, an audience that didn't care too much about the soapy relationships between high school students and was more interested in maybe an underground resistance or, you know what I mean? So I think they've kind of set a new bar and they did it in a more traditional way than a show like Legion did, especially when we get the Inhumans in the same week as The Gifted or in the same 7-day period. It's definitely setting a higher bar than most of these other superhero shows. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but that's,
no,
that's my
I think-
point.
Look, I don't want to talk about Inhumans. You know, like I
neither do I.
I don't want to talk about Inhumans, which just premiered on ABC over this past weekend that we just came out of. I don't want to talk about how that show had the audacity of having an IMAX premiere for a show that very much does not deserve any kind of IMAX treatment whatsoever. And I don't know if you went and saw that, John, but circumstances prevented me from going and seeking it out in IMAX, although I was originally going to for work. And when I bought my tickets for it, it was like I bought them like 3 nights before. And the entire theater was, you know, the world was my oyster in terms of seats that I could have chosen.
I can imagine.
You know,
Josh, why did they put money into a show, money into that marketing push and that launch onto a show that they're airing on Friday that has, like, that they're burying? Like, I just don't understand the whole premise around that IMAX premiere. But anyway, that's a whole other story.
They made a mistake and they feel bad and they should feel bad and they don't really know exactly what to do about it. But we're not talking about Inhumans.
Thank
but
God.
That's just an example of one of the shows that is now out on television, one of the new Marvel TV series that's out that I think is just bad. It's just straight up rotten and really, really bad. Like, if you thought Jim Gibbons and I were hard on The Defenders or hard on Iron Fist, imagine what it would have sounded like if we'd gotten our hands on Inhumans. It would have been rough. The good news is, John, I think you and I are definitely on the same page with The Gifted. I think that The Gifted is it's off to a really cool start. It's one episode, so it's impossible to judge if this is going to, you know, be something that maintains, but I think it begins in this interesting way. And it's hard to cut through the noise right now on television, and especially with superhero TV as well. I mean, just looking at the list of active Marvel TV shows right now, I think we're looking at 9 shows that are currently on, maybe 8 shows that are currently on if you're counting the Netflix series. That doesn't account for the fact that The Punisher is going to drop any minute now. Runaways is coming up. There's a Cloak and Dagger show and New Warriors coming to Freeform at some point in 2018. So it really requires a little bit of gumption and a little bit of actual effort to really break through the chatter when it comes to these Marvel TV shows. That's not even accounting for all the DC stuff as well. But I think the Gifted deserves a shot. I agree with you. I loved Legion, which is the other live action X-Men show or based in X-Men comics show that is out there right now. It's about 8 episodes long that first season. I think it hit FX. Definitely more on the mature side in terms of the content. I think The Gifted is a little bit more family friendly, but still pretty dark in its own right. John, I'd love for you to set up just what exactly The Gifted even is. I think it does suffer from a little bit of a branding issue where they're not even throwing the X in the title. Like, I understand you don't want to call this X-Men. I mean, I understand it. I don't like why you wouldn't, you know, why not just give us an X-Men show the same way? Why not just give us a Batman show instead of calling it Gotham? But you're calling it The Gifted. You're leaving X completely out of the title. If you were just wandering into the show, you might not know it's an X-Men show until you really started digging into it. What is this whole thing about?
But Josh, they dotted the I with a little X-Men logo. It's so creative. This show's really interesting because it takes a lot from a comic book series that got turned into a movie. And I think this is some maybe ideas that got left on the cutting room floor. This reminds me of Days of Future Past in a lot of ways. It's taking a lot of characters from the Age of Apocalypse. But Days of Future Past was a comic book in which the X-Men were gone. Like the high-level mutants were all killed off or disappeared. The Sentinels had got them. And all the mutants, all these kind of second-rate mutants, had to go underground in fear of being killed off by Sentinels. And I feel like that's where we're picking up this story. The X-Men have disappeared. The Gifted are on the run from these government organizations that are hunting them down because the government has signed the the Registration Act. I don't know exactly where in continuity this is falling with the movies because the movies aren't my favorite things. But I think this is falling somewhere where they have to register or they're being hunted down by the government, clearly. And the Sentinel Corporation or the Sentinel Services has been set up building the Sentinel machines. I can't believe we got Sentinels in this first episode. Sorry, I'm going off topic. But so this is, to me, this is where Days of Future Past, the comic book, starts off, where the X-Men are gone and we've got a bunch of underground mutants trying to be scrappy and survive and figure out where they fit into the world.
You mentioned that the Sentinels are in this episode. Are Sentinel spiders a thing? I guess I'm not super aware of Sentinel spiders, if that's a deal. That's what it seems like we're looking at in this first episode.
Like Slayer spiders? I think these are going to be just the like feet of the eventual Sentinel, right? Like these are the toes for what will then become the giant Sentinel that we'll see at the end of season 3.
So it's like the Thing and not like the Fantastic Four thing. I'm talking Thing of Adam's family. Yeah, they're just running around. I loved Thing. So if you give some personality to these Sentinel feet, I might be on board with that. That sounds like that could be fun.
What did you think about the Sentinel feet? Did you enjoy that they were included in this way in this episode?
You know, you gotta listen, if you're gonna introduce something called Sentinel Services into the universe of the Gifted in the first episode, like you gotta give us like some sort of robotics. And I think like you can't go full Sentinel in your first episode. You know, you're not gonna blow the full budget on full Sentinel, but hopefully that's something we're gonna build toward. Like if it's gonna take 6 seasons to see a Sentinel on this show, that's where you're going to lose me. You will lose me very quickly. But one of the things that I loved about The Gifted is, you're right, like it's setting up that this is a universe where the X-Men existed, the Brotherhood of Mutants existed. Like, we don't know where exactly in the continuity of the X-Men movies The Gifted falls. And in fact, Matt Nix, when I asked him that question, Matt Nix being the writer of this episode and the creator of the show and the showrunner, he talked about how the X-Men movies have done them a very big solid in that they really blew up their own timeline with Days of Future Past. So you really, and like even before that, like if you start lining up some of the characters that appear in First Class, the first of the prequel movies that takes place in the 1960s, and you try to fit that up continuity-wise with Bryan Singer's X-Men movies, plus the Brett Ratner X-Men movie that we never talk about, that it just like the continuity doesn't line up. It doesn't make sense. So Matt Nix and the writers apparently feel free to explore their own corner of the X-Men universe where they don't feel...
Backhanded compliment, man. Like, hey, they did this solid for us by totally screwing up continuity and going all over the going off the grid. Like,
you know,
that is so hilarious.
He's right, though. He's absolutely right that, you know, there's really not a lot of rhyme or reason to the X-Men movies. And so if you're really trying to interact with the X-Men film world, it's going to be really difficult. And it's also going to be frustrating because you're never going to have a shot to have like Cyclops or Wolverine or Professor X show up on your show if you're beholden to like the James Marsden, Hugh Jackman, and Patrick Stewart interpretations of those characters. It's just never going to happen. And we're probably never going to get those characters on The Gifted either, but at least you have the possibility of that if you're not being so beholden to the films. So The Gifted, I think, is very wisely telling an X-Men story in its own X-Men universe that I think is only going to like tangentially rub up against the movies that Bryan Singer kicked off. That being said, Bryan Singer is one of the producers on this project, as are all of the people who are involved in the film side of the X-Men, and Bryan Singer directed this first episode. How did you feel about that, John Reed?
I'm really happy that they got his episode out of the way early and he doesn't have to have as much input going forward. I am not a Bryan Singer working on the X-Men fan. I think the best movie was the one he had the least involvement with. I think Legion is a really interesting project, which I also think is he's an executive producer, but it's very different from any of the stuff he's ever done. And I'm more excited to see what Matt Nix can do than what Bryan Singer can do. If this is all we get from Bryan Singer, I won't cry any sad tears.
I mean, I think that he does a good job in setting the visual tone for the series, which is kind of odd because I the X-Men, the first movie, the original Bryan Singer X-Men movie is in a lot of ways the kickstart of the modern superhero film universes. You know, like that's where we're really starting to build momentum. That's while Batman is still on hiatus because nobody has forgiven the bat nipples yet. Spider-Man hasn't really become quite a big thing yet. We certainly aren't looking at Iron Man or any of those characters. The Batman Begins and the Dark Knight of it all, none of that has happened yet. It really does feel to me anyway like it starts with X-Men, but it also starts on this note of, we can't have the X-Men in like classic superhero costumes. We got to give them black spandex. We got to give them black leather. We even have to make fun of the spandex from the costume from the comics. So there was just like this sort of resistance to being really comic booky that I always found a little repellent about the way that Singer approaches the X-Men from a film standpoint. But I don't know. I thought that The Gifted did like kind of a pretty incredible job of like capturing the mutant experience as far as I've always enjoyed it from the comics and as far as I've enjoyed it from, you know, animated projects surrounding the X-Men. Like there's just such a casual way that the powers are playing out in this first action scene, even this new character, Eclipse, who's like kind of the show's take on Sunspot, right? You know, I saw you react.
Well, okay, so no, I do. I have a reaction to that because it's this blending. I feel very strongly about Eclipse. I think that Eclipse was one of the smartest things the show did because one of the main things about Lorna's character, she's always part of a crazy love triangle. She's always part of some sort of unhinged love triangle. The first one was with Iceman and Havoc. Those three characters, because of that love triangle, became my three favorite comic book characters of all time. And so what they've done with Eclipse is not only give him Sunspot's powers, which I think are really interesting powers, but they put him in the Havoc spot because they couldn't use Havoc. And that's where I think the show is going to get really interesting. They're going to throw a love triangle at us, I believe. And we're basically just substituting Eclipse in for where Havoc fits in the story with Sunspot's better powers. So yes, yes and no. I think that he's like a combination of
the two. He seems like he's a hybrid of a few different characters. But I think the thing that I liked about it so much was that you got this, you have this opening scene that is showing you just what can be accomplished with the power sets on this show. And I think that the power sets have been really smartly created for television. Like I think that Polaris's use of magnetism and Eclipse's use of solar-based power and Thunderbird's heightened tracking senses, these are all very easy to convey on television on a TV budget. And even everything that we're seeing from the Strucker children, we don't really know exactly what it is that they are capable of at this point. Andy seems to have some sort of telekinetic rage. Lauren can shift molecules in the air. These are powers that you can get away with in like a pretty clean way, just from like certainly in Andy's case, from a lot of it being just like, you know, practical on set effects. So I think it's really smart. And I think the way that Singer shot it, and I think the visual language that he's created for this show, a lot of it, of course, does come from the writing. But I think just the way that it was filmed and the way that it was set up, I think it's a really smart template for what should be a really palatable, you know, series of powers that we're going to see from some of these characters as we move forward in The Gifted.
I feel like the visual language is very much a perfect balance between three entities: Matt Nix, Bryan Singer, and Fox. I feel like it looks a little bit like 24 and a little bit like Buffy, you know, that kind of Fox desaturated, crank the blues kind of a look, with Bryan Singer's kind of costume design on the whole thing. With, I think Matt Nix is probably the one inserting, like, Blink looked much more like Blink than I thought she was going to end up looking on the show. She had the eyes, she had the ears, she had a pink hue, she had the scar around her eye. Those were things I thought they might shy away from on this show because it was on Fox and not FX or ABC or whatever, right? But they didn't. And I like that they're going fully there with the look of the characters, even if they're not going fully there on the costumes. And, you know, I think Fox has a specific look that it's going for. I think the studio kind of has a look that it goes for to make its shows kind of blend together. And I think that that's maybe what we're also seeing in this. It really reminded me of old Buffy and Angel episodes with an updated effects budget. You know, I love how Blink's power looked. Again, I didn't think that they were going to go fully there. I thought she was going to maybe teleport around, but actually having her make the big pink Blink portals, like, they gave Blink the portal gun that I've been waiting
for. They're going for it.
Yeah, it's great.
You know, they're going for it.
I love it.
It's good. It's fun. Yes. It's fun. It's fun. It's queer that the people making the show are fans. And I think that that's something, again, to compare it to something like Inhumans, where it doesn't feel like there is an understanding of the source material. Like, here it feels like the people who are making the show, they're X-Men fans, or at least they've done their homework at the very least.
And I would argue that the X-Men is harder to do than the Inhumans. I think there's a comic book out there by Jay Lee that you could pretty much adapt word for word for the Inhumans. And I feel like the X-Men, you're wading into a whole bunch of movie continuity, tons of really disparate storytelling. The X-Men is really more a soap opera than anything else. So you have to figure out where the entry point is. And it's crazy to me that they are able to come out with this high of quality for this pilot against the Inhumans, which it should have been an easier story to tell early on. But
all right, so let's talk through some of the specific mutants that we see in this show. We don't see any X-Men because as we are embarking into this universe, the X-Men no longer exist. The Brotherhood no longer exist. We don't know exactly what that means. I think we're left to assume that they're dead or they've disappeared and gone underground themselves. Again, Matt Nix, pulling from my interview with him, has said that this is not going to be a show about what happened to the X-Men and let's go find the X-Men, but their absence is definitely going to be a big part of the story in some capacity, at least, so we can expect some resolution on that front. But what we are left with is at least four mutants who are part of the Mutant Underground, one of them who is drawn into the Mutant Underground over the course of this episode. But that's Eclipse, that's Polaris, that's Thunderbird, and that's Blink. Can you walk us through who those four characters are if we have never picked up an X-Men comic book in our life? Starting with Eclipse, who is newly invented for the show.
Yeah, so Eclipse is newly invented for the show. I touched on it a little bit. He's basically Sunspot, which was a new mutant created, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s. No, the 80s, definitely in the 80s.
That's such a confusing sentence, a new mutant created in the 80s, if you have no idea what that means. The New Mutants was a name of a comic book.
Yes. The New Mutants was a spinoff for the X-Men in the 80s, and he was part of the original crew. I believe there is an Eclipse in the comics. Somebody I'm not very familiar with, but I did really love that they gave us Sunspot / Havoc in this form, and that the actor did a great job of portraying it. It seems like his powers are some sort of photon manipulation. He can create lasers and slice things, you know, big heavy things. So it'll be fun.
So tell me a little bit about Polaris. Polaris, who is the member of the Mutant Underground who is captured at the end of the first act of the entire episode, at the end of this first action sequence, that is. And we also are going to find out that she is pregnant with Eclipse's child, which is tantalizing.
Which is not where I thought they were going there. When they mentioned her medical problem, in the comic books, Polaris has a different medical problem. She's schizophrenic. She's got some sort of, you know, mental problems. She's unhinged in a lot of ways. She goes evil a lot. So I thought that that's where they were going. Like, maybe they were going to make her schizophrenic or something like that in this. But instead, she's pregnant. So it went a very different direction. Polaris was added to the original X-Men crew back in the 60s. She was actually added just after the original five. So you have Iceman, Angel, Beast, Cyclops, and Jean. And then they added in Havoc, who's Cyclops' brother, and Lorna Dane, who's Polaris. So she's one of the earliest X-Men ever. But she never quite gelled with the team because she's so erratic. There's some discussion about her parentage, whether or not she's Magneto's daughter. There have been yeses and nos depending on who's writing the character. But Polaris is probably my favorite female X-Men. She goes back far enough that there's a lot of history there, and her relationships with Havoc and Iceman, who is my favorite character, has impacted my psyche, I guess. So Polaris is one of those that I've honed in on, and I'm really excited to see what they do with. It seems as if they've gone full Polaris. She's got her manipulation of metal, just like Magneto. She may or may not have her telepathy and psychic abilities in this, but we shall see.
She's also rocking sweet green hair in the comics that has not seemed to follow her totally to the Gifted, at least. I don't know if there were like green highlights in there. I couldn't tell. It was kind of dark.
I think they used green lights. Yeah, I think they went that route. Hopefully she gets the sweet green hair, because that, I think, may have been what attracted me to her back when I was in high school. I love that green hair. Hopefully she gets
it. Just a cool look. I love the look. I think it's a cool look.
Yes, me too.
But yeah, I mean, we kind of, yada yada past a fairly significant potential part of the mythology with this character, is that, as you said, there have been versions of this character where it's a lot of like, is she or isn't she Magneto's daughter? Magneto being the most prominent X-Men villain by far and away, potentially, like a top five comic book bad guy. I mean, I don't even think potentially. I think Magneto's got to be in that conversation. Probably not a character we're going to see in The Gifted, I would bet. I don't know that Fox is going to allow Magneto to appear on one of their TV shows.
Fassbender will show up. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's all, this is where I get into like getting furious at all of these comic book TV shows where they're just handcuffed and not allowed to really explore their entire gallery of characters. But whatever, we don't have to get into a complete rage about this. Either way, it seems to me like it would be a completely missed opportunity if The Gifted is existing in a universe where the X-Men and the Brotherhood at least once existed, and Polaris has this history from the comics where she may or may not be Magneto's daughter. She has to be Magneto's daughter on the show, right?
You would assume. I really hope they go that direction, but they haven't even gone that fully in the comic books yet. So it would be interesting if we got confirmation of that in the show, but not in the comics. Maybe it's easier to do in the show because the mythology isn't quite as built out. I hope we do, though. I hope that they at least make that link. I hope we don't have another Striker not Strucker thing going on, or Von Strucker not Strucker. So maybe. I hope so. I hope they go fully there, because they definitely took some quick off ramps already on this show, and I hope that they don't with that. What about you? Do you think they'll go fully there, Josh?
Yeah. I do. I think they got to. I think that's too dramatically rich not to get into the territory of Magneto. And
if he doesn't show up, though, like, maybe they want her dad to actually show up on the show.
If Magneto is dead and Polaris now has to like take on the legacy of her father and like take on the mantle of her father, and you just channel all of that great plot energy of Magneto into this character, yeah, I think that would work totally. I think that would definitely hit. It's all in, the writing of these characters that are now established. I think that there's a lot that you could pour into them as avatars for some of the other ideas that have been explored in the X-Men mythos over the years. I think it would be too, if I were writing the show, it would be irresistible to go in that direction with this character. And I also don't know why you even have Polaris on the show unless you're planning on going in that direction. I get that she would be a character that maybe you are allowed to include here in your X-Men TV series, but I think that that's the most interesting possible direction. If you need like a Magneto stand-in, Polaris is somebody who could really fill that role. And especially the actress Emma Dumont, I thought, did such a good job as this character in that scene where she is incarcerated and she's using her powers to kind of toy with Reed Strucker, played by Stephen Moyer of True Blood fame, Vampire Bill Suke, who is also married to Rogue in real life. It's all very complicated. But she has this scene where she's playing with like the screws in his knee from an old sports injury, and she's just doing it so calmly and casually. And you can imagine, the anti-human rhetoric getting turned up a little bit as, the longer that Lorna is in captivity, and who knows what happens with her impending motherhood and everything like that. I feel like it could be a really intense direction for this character, and I think that they've cast it in such a way that they've found someone in Emma Dumont who could really bring it. So I'm hopeful. I think it'd be cool.
I think you actually cracked the case, Josh. I think that the reason Lorna is here as a stand-in for Magneto is because Bryan Singer always needs to have a plastic plastic jail in everything that he does.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So that's the only way he could get it done. He had to he had to cast a whole new character, a whole new young female Magneto to do the trick.
He loves those plastic prisons. Yes. All right. Well, let's talk about another character who is on the show and also hails from the comics, and that's the actor Blair Redford playing John Proudstar, aka Thunderbird, which, if you've read the comics, comes with like a little bit of like a little bit of like some heavy breathing when you see this character on the show. Like, you're kind of waiting for something to happen to issue just like the mildest of spoiler alerts, just in case the show ever decides to go in this direction. Maybe tune out now if you don't want to hear anything that's rooted so deeply in the comics. That's all the spoiler warning you're going to get. John, if you're doing the death draft of which of the series regulars are going to make it out of the first season of The Gifted alive, you gotta, or are going to die in the first season, I feel like you have to have Thunderbird super high, if not the number one on the board here. Could you explain the history of Thunderbird to people?
Sure. So you're right. First of all, he'd have to be high up there. If they didn't have this actor playing him, he's one of the more high profile. I mean, they've got a lot of high profile actors, but he's one of them. And I think that, anyway, he gets introduced when the X-Men expands dramatically in the 70s. I believe that's in Giant Size X-Men, right? Anyway,
yeah.
He does not make it out of his first arc in the comic books. His mantle gets taken over by his brother, who becomes Warbird, correct? Anyway, there's a lot
Warpath.
There. Warpath, right. It's one of those characters that I never really got deep into, but he also, I think one of the reasons they're using him is because an alternate version of him, or an earlier timeline version of him, also is part of the Exiles, where Blink has most of her action taking place. So Thunderbird was a big part of the Exiles as well. So maybe it's that version and he actually gets to last for more than three issues.
I hope that that's the case, because I'm really liking Thunderbird so far. You know, he's just kind of this measured guy. He's very useful to the underground so far. Seems like he's got some leadership qualities in his own right as well. Cool to get some representation here on the show as well, just to kind of diversify the lineup. Yeah. I really like that. And he's just, I don't know, he's just cool. I like the way that they're showing off his powers too. Like, this could be a little bit hokey that, like, he's a great tracker. Like, you know, like, that could be kind of dorky, but I think that they've done a good job with it. But I'm just on the edge of my seat wondering, like, could we lose this character? Could we lose Thunderbird at some point over the course of these next few episodes?
We know he has a brother, so possibly, because the reason they wouldn't do it is because he's their Cerebro, right? Like, he's the one who helps them track down other mutants, and if they're going to end up probably building out this underground mutants, they're going to need somebody who can track mutants down. And so I feel like he's going to kind of be that plot device going forward. They didn't really flesh out his character too much. It doesn't seem like he has really strong connections like everyone else does. He's just kind of best friends with Eclipse, right? So I have a feeling that he's either going to stick around or get replaced by his bro, who will look exactly like him if he played by the same actor.
All right, well, we'll see how that plays out. All right, last of the established mutants that is on the show is Blink, who is a character that I'm quite fond of. I imagine you are a big fan as well, John Reed. Who is Blink? She seems, just from the outside looking in, if you have at least seen the first two Singer X-Men movies, is this just Lady Nightcrawler? She seems to have the same powers. She kind of has this elvish, demonic look about her as well. But she's more than that. She is a character who comes with a lot of cool comic book history and hails from what I'm imagining is both of our one of our favorite X-Men arcs of all time, Age of Apocalypse in the 90s. Talk to me about Blink, John.
Blink, yes, I love Blink so much. She actually did appear before the Age of Apocalypse. She was in a short run on Generation X, which was another X-Men spinoff, where she was a random mutant that saves all of Generation X's lives and then dies right away. So she's in two issues. They liked the character so much and the look of the character and the feel of it that they bring her back for this alt dimension Age of Apocalypse series, which happens not in the real Marvel proper, the 616 universe. So they introduce her there, and she's so good in this mini series that then they give her her own series of Exiles years later, written by Judd Winnick, who was on Real World. And another Real World connection, Jamie Chung was also on Real World, and she's playing Blink. She was on Real World.
That's right.
San Diego. Yeah, so Winnick made the character popular, and she gets to play it, which is kind of great. But yeah, Blink is able to, basically, if you've played the video game Portal, she has a built-in portal gun. She can shoot a space in one place, and then another one in another place, and then those two connect like a wormhole, and you can walk through it or teleport through it. I like that we're getting her in between her Generation X and Age of Apocalypse characters, where she's still figuring out her powers. She's not super powerful yet. She can't hold the blinks open very long. She's not at the point where she can open like three at a time and have Gambit throw his cards through and have them pop up behind a bad guy, right? She's not there yet. So I'm excited to see the growth of the powers, and I'm really excited to see Jamie play it. We went to high school together. We share a birthday. We've partied a lot, and
whoa,
she's really great.
How about
yes.
that?
Yes. So I'm like doubly excited to see her playing Blink.
Wow, you're invested in the Blink. That's cool. That's awesome. That's a great connection.
Yeah.
What do you think are the odds that this Blink is from a different dimension, from a different timeline, from some sort of different universe? There does seem to be some uncertainty around the character as she's introduced in this first episode.
I think that it's very, very possible, and it'll open the path to all sorts of mini arcs within the show where they can go to these other dimensions that maybe she can connect to. So I think that that could be a really exciting thing, and I think it's very highly probable. We also haven't seen many mutants that look that different on these movies and shows. Like, it's a lot of like humans that can like change, and she's somebody who like a Morlock in the comics would have to be underground, or everyone would know she's a mutant. So I think that it's she seems to be more extreme than everyone else around her as far as the visual style and everything, which probably lends itself to being from some other dimension.
All right. So I think, you know, those are the most exciting characters to talk about right out the gate. But really what seems to be the heart of the show is this foursome, this family, the Strucker family, with Reed Strucker, the patriarch, played once again by Vampire Bill of True Blood fame, Stephen Moyer, who is playing. He's a prosecutor. He is an attorney. He's coming out after mutants that he deems worthy of prosecution, people who are committing crimes. But there's a lot of argument throughout this first episode, even of like, well, what does that really mean? Like, when you think about it from the mutant's perspective, what choices do some of these people really, really have? And who are you really throwing the book at? So that's where he's kind of coming from philosophically. There's also Amy Acker, who is a geek icon for so many reasons, from the Whedonverse to Person of Interest. She was on Alias. You know, really the list goes on. For her, I think she was even on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, these two Marvel shows not connected at all, so a different character. But this person with so much geek cred is playing Caitlin Strucker, who is Reed's wife and is the mother to the two children in the Strucker family, Lauren and Andy. Lauren played by Natalie Allen Lind, and Andy played by Percy Hines White, both of whom seem to carry the mutant gene. And by seem to carry the mutant gene, I mean they just straight up carry the
yeah,
mutant gene. They are mutants. They are outright persons of genetic difference, as the show would like to label them. What do you think of the Strucker family so far? These are characters that are invented for the show, though you can raise your eyebrows at their last name as long as you'd like.
So let's touch on that real quickly first. I don't know what legal team allowed them to say, like, no, these aren't the Von Struckers. They're just the Struckers. Yay, we got around that legal loophole. Like, and why couldn't they just have it be the Strikers? Like, couldn't it have been like Stryker's cousin and his children, right? Like, already in the government, already in the movies. So it seems like a very weird choice to make just to have the Von Strucker twins in some other form on the show. I don't know. Do you think it's a little...
So who are the Von Strucker twins for anyone who might be lost on that?
So the Von Strucker twins are the kids of Baron Von Strucker, who is a Captain America villain. And he was part of like the World War II arc, right? So he's this villain that Marvel still owns, that's not part of the X-Men. So Fox doesn't have the rights to use Baron Von Strucker. So somehow they've gotten around that and created Reed Strucker. And so Baron Von Strucker had these two kids, these two twins, who when they touch, they have crazy powers that are very similar to the to Lauren and Andy. Their names were Andrea and Andreas. So Andy is literally named the same way. So it seems like it's the Von Strucker twins that we're dealing with here. And it seemed like a long way to go to get these really obscure comic book characters as the main characters of this show that they don't have rights to.
That feels like a reach. Feels like a reach.
Right?
Yeah, that feels like you're going really far to bring in some, you know, D-list supervillains into the mix here. So I wonder if it's just kind of like a reference point for people who are really deep cut. I can't imagine that they will go all the way in on like all of like the deep-rooted history of those characters. Like that feels too far afield for me.
I kept thinking that Reed was going to betray his family because of the name. I was like, well, Baron Von Strucker is a bad guy. So Reed's got to be selling out his kids when the Sentinels came at the end. So they, I guess using it did have a good little plot twist for anyone who knows the Von Struckers in this first episode. But that's like three people. So I don't know why they would go that farther away. And like I said, you could just have them be the Strikers and it would make way more sense. So I don't know. But that said, I really, really, really like the actors playing the Von Strucker siblings. They look like your typical CW actors, but somehow they like transcended that in this episode. I thought that they were really mature and really interesting in this. They're probably like 30 years old, but you know, they come off as teenagers. And I don't know. I thought that they were fantastic and the powers just looked so cool the whole time. They went all in on the telekinetic rage part of the show and when he was being bullied. And I thought that it was, I just thought it was really excellent. What do you think, John?
Excellent without the E. I thought the first of all that bullying scene when Andy's just like getting tortured in the locker room, evocative. You know, it was triggering, definitely triggering. Like I felt my latent mutant powers were starting to activate there. I was furious. So great depiction of high school bullying right there.
Yep.
I thought that was pretty good. No, I like these characters a lot too, and I think with Lauren, you're kind of getting those save the cheerleader, save the world vibes as well. So I think she's a good character. I like that she has she already has her mutant powers by the time that this show is starting, and she's just been hiding them from everybody else that she knows in her life. And man, if that doesn't make you wonder about Amy Acker's character,
yes,
about Caitlin Strucker, about the matriarch of this family, both Stephen Moyer and Amy Acker, it's hard for me to imagine these two really recognizable people in the TV landscape, especially being drawn into the world of the X-Men on a regular basis as their new day job and not getting a chance to like really get in on the superheroics themselves. And I don't know that they could get away with having both of them be like secret mutants, but I do think you could get away with it for one of them. And I think that you could probably see the scenario where Amy Acker as Caitlin Strucker has been hiding some sort of mutant power from people all her life. What do you think about that? Do you think that there's going to be some sort of superpower twist with either of the Strucker parents?
It's funny because I went the opposite direction. I thought it was going to be Reed because Amy Acker was so indignant with her daughter about hiding her powers. It just seems so like she's in a tizzy about this whole thing. She did an amazing job in this episode, by the way. Her reaction as a mother having this happen to her kids while her husband works to like round up mutants that cause problems, and now her kids are mutants that are causing problems, it was just so fantastic. I thought she was so great. So her reactions kind of sold that she's not hiding anything to me. So I thought maybe Reed was. In my head, I was writing the show where Kate Strucker meets Forge and she becomes like an Iron Man character, you know, like she's surrounded by all these people and she starts getting like all these gadgets and becomes like a badass, like matriarch, Iron Man type character. So I don't know. I think Reed probably has a higher probability in my mind, but I could see it going either way. Just like, and I think that'll be an amazing plot twist because like you said, these actors are so fantastic that whatever they give them, they'll be able to shine with, especially if they can literally shine. So yeah, it'll be good.
One of the things that I really like about this show, and I think that you kind of just lobbed it up, is that you don't really have a sense of what the show is by the end of the pilot. Like, you thought that maybe it's going to be like the family on the run, and where is that going to lead to? But the family's already been separated, and so now you've got Reed, who's been captured by Sentinel Services. Gotta imagine he's on a collision course with Polaris, and now the interests of the Mutant Underground and the remaining Strucker family are aligned, and how is that all going to play out? And you would think that that's probably going to be the thrust for the next little while, but that can't sustain an entire show. So you don't really know exactly what this show is going to be. Like, it's not like an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. where you can kind of imagine that it's going to be the mission of the week, or even a Flash or an Arrow or something like that, where it's, you know, villain of the week, or there's already just some sort of established villain arc for the season. I don't think that we're really getting that sense here with The Gifted. This is a show where, you know, much like the X-Men, you're kind of not entirely sure what direction it can go because there's so many different possible ways that it can go. Much like Blink can just blink you into a completely different space in the blink of an eye and the toss of a portal. You know, this is a show that could potentially go into completely different settings very, very quickly, whether those are physical locations, whether those are emotional locations, whether those are, you know, temporal distances. We're going across time. I think that's something that the show Legion did do extraordinarily well, which was create all of these different settings and set pieces and you know, plot points across all of these different realms of existence, let alone physical distance. So that's probably the thing that I'm the most excited about slash worried about when it comes to The Gifted, is that I don't really know what this show wants to be and what it plans to be. I don't know if the show yet even knows those answers, but the possibilities of what it can be and the possibilities of where it can go, given the fact that this is about, you know, a group of people that are heavily powered, have these outrageous abilities that are very different from one another and are really only limited to the imagination in terms of what they can do, that can really burst you into different types of genre and different types of stories, much like what you outlined, like a Caitlin Strucker getting shot into the future and teaming up with the great mutant Forge, who could like outfit her with all sorts of different weaponry and all sorts of cybernetics and everything like that. I think that that's the potential for something like that. That's very exciting if you could imagine like a season two set in a parallel dimension, or even a part of season one set in the future. Who really knows? The sky's kind of the limit right now, which is exciting when it does seem like there is a level of passion and know-how and craft behind the creation of this first episode. So I think there's a lot of potential here is what I'm saying.
You get the idea that they care about the characterization more than anything else, right? They want to make sure that they get these characters right, or at least that's how the pilot comes across, which is something that they haven't been super careful with in the X-Men universe, quite honestly. So that's the thing that's the most exciting to me, because once you get the heart of the characters that have captured my imagination and many people's imaginations for so long, I think you can pretty much do whatever you want. And you're going to miss here and there, I'm sure. But if this show becomes what the shows that, like, typically the shows that I love are season-long arcs or half-season-long arcs with one big bad that's kind of a looming threat, and then they throw a bunch of little bad, you know, mini bosses in along the way, right? And I think that that's where this show could go. I think that's where the show should go. I just don't know if that's necessarily where it's going. It could just be a Mutants on the Run story for many, many seasons. I'm hoping that they kind of tie that up at least by the end of this season, if not a little bit earlier, and they start throwing some villains of the season at us in future seasons. Because I'd love to see, you know, Blink going up against Sabretooth or something like that, right? Well, we probably won't get that, but some sort of a cool villain, you know, hopping on the scene and being another threat on top of the Sentinels. So right now they're mining a lot from God Loves, Man Kills and Days of Future Past and Age of Apocalypse, these kind of huge X-Men storylines, and they're taking what they like out of them. But I think they'll have to kind of go off script at a certain point. And when they do that, I hope they're able to really give us some unique, cool stuff. And there's so many characters, right? Like, we're talking about Blink and Polaris on a primetime network TV show, Joss. Like, this is crazy. Like, I never thought I'd see the day where Blink shows up on my TV on Fox at, you know, 9 o'clock on a Monday. It's nuts.
You mentioned before a bunch of different comic book titles by story arc specifically. What would you say is like the reading list for The Gifted? Like if you were going to toss out, let's call it five essential bits of reading material from X-Men lore for anybody who would be really interested in digging a little bit deeper and gaining a little bit more of a base of knowledge for some of these characters and maybe some of the themes that are at play here in The Gifted, what are some of the titles that you would refer people to? And let's try and limit it to five.
Yeah, so the five I would say, I've just listed three of them. God Loves, Man Kills is a Chris Claremont written run of the X-Men. You can just type that in, God Loves, Man Kills, and you'll get the graphic novel of that or the compilation of that. I think that's probably the one Singer has drawn the most on throughout all of the movies. It has a lot to do with the government and religious groups hunting down mutants and you know, making them, relegating them to the fringes of society. I would also say Days of Future Past and Age of Apocalypse, both of which were made into movies, but I feel like they're using a lot of those stories that they had to leave on the cutting room floor due to time restrictions that you get with movies. A lot of the like underground mutant stuff is coming from both Days of Future Past and Age of Apocalypse. So I would throw those two in there. Those are probably the best crossovers ever for the X-Men. It's definitely not drawing on Dark Phoenix, which is the best one in the next movie. Then I would say, once you've gone there, read The Exiles. I don't know if you agree with me, but Judd Winnick's first run on The Exiles is where Blink really comes in. Like, it's the first time Blink is the leader of a group and has to carry an ongoing comic book series. You also get a version of Thunderbird in it. And you get a Lady Nightcrawler, which is what people are saying Blink is. So I recommend The Exiles as well. And I don't know, to round it out, you could probably read some Generation X books No, that's not true. There's a comic series called Muties. And a lot of the stuff going on with the Struckers is taken right out of that. It's about kind of the bullying of mutant children and how that kind of explodes. So it's a hardcore comic book, adult comic book. It's called Muties. You can check that out as well.
Okay, cool. Before we wrap up here, there's two things I at least want to get your take on. One is the obligatory Stan Lee cameo. Thumbs up, thumbs down. How did you feel about that?
Is he going to show up in every episode? Like, no. Is he just going to hang out in Texas all the time? It was good. You know, Stan Lee showing up is always great. It was probably filming around the time where his wife passed away, which is a very, very tough for him. So it's good to see that he's still doing these cameos and showing up on all these properties that he's created so many of these characters that I just love seeing him show up. So it wasn't the most creative, but you know, he's on Fox. It's great.
Matt Nix told me a great story about how that came together. Stan Lee was at a comic convention in Los Angeles and was about to get on an airplane to go somewhere else. And the people behind The Gifted found out about it and contacted the convention, and the people at the convention said, yeah, like if you can get down here in like the next hour, and if you can be finished shooting with him in 2 hours at this like restaurant, yeah, you could do it. And they're like, all right, go. Everybody go. Everybody make this work. Everybody figure out how to get Stan Lee on here. And so they did it. So that's why it's, you know, kind of one note. It's not like he gets any sort of gag or anything. You're really just seeing Stan Lee. But I'm with you. Like, as you know, as long as we can get these Stan Lee cameos, let's keep racking them up. You know, eventually the day will come where you will regret not getting more Stan Lee cameos. So
never,
you know,
never happening. You know? He's always with us.
He is with us forever. Final one for you is, how about that ringtone? How about the fact that there was a great, great nod to the 1990s Fox animated X-Men series, which if you haven't watched that, oh my, what a formative show for me at least.
Yeah, it was the 90s TV show, the cartoon, the show that got you into X-Men as well, Josh?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, it was those and like the Toy Biz action figures that came out around the same time. I was all in on both of them.
Yeah, me too. Jubilee is still one of my favorite characters. Just because of that TV show, she's pretty much an awful character. I loved her on the 90s cartoon. Yes, the ringtone was also cool because I don't know if you noticed, they cut it off before the most recognizable piece of it. So you had to really know that theme song to catch it. And so it was great. I loved that Eclipse's ringtone is actually the 90s X-Men cartoon theme song. There were some cool Easter eggs. There was also a Wolverine painting at Texas Bar. which
cool.
I thought was also really cool. Like, a painting on the wall of Wolverine at the bar. So, you know, if we do any more of these, I'll point out some more Easter eggs, but they're doing a good job with them so far. They're not ham-handed.
All right, so far, one episode into The Gifted, John Reed is how many claws up?
He's got six, right? Well, I guess X-23. Well, she's got the 2 feet claws, so six.
Let's go with
plus
Wolverine claws, just to simplify.
Six claws
so six,
up. Yeah.
Six total claws. You're going full six?
Full six. I'm full six on this.
All right, six claws up. John, what else do you have going on? What's going on in your podcasting world right now?
Well, we're podcasting about pretty much everything that's comic book related on TV. We try to check out the movies as well. So we're roasting the Inhumans every week. We're going to be talking about The Gifted in Star Trek. We've got Mr. Robot starting up next Wednesday, I think. And then we cover all of the CW superhero shows in one big roundup on Fridays. So that's what we have up until Runaways drops in November and we get all of that crazy stuff in the spring. So, you know, if you like comics and you like TV, you know, we've got stuff for you over at nerdrotic.com or on YouTube.
Cool. Awesome. All right. So you guys check out Nerdrotic for all of your superhero shenanigans and all of your needs on that front. Are you keeping an eye out for Punisher? When do you think Punisher's dropping? It's supposed to drop any minute now.
Yeah, we've had so many arguments about that on our news show. I believe that it's going to probably go up against Runaways. I think they're going to drop it right around Thanksgiving.
Okay, so keep an eye out for Punisher coverage. It's going to come to post-show recaps as well. Jim Gibbons and I will have shows for you as soon as the Punisher drops.
Oh, sweet.
We'll keep our fingers on the pulse of The Gifted. We'll see. Maybe we'll check back in later in the season, John, and see how we're feeling about this show. Hopefully we're both still as high on it mid-season as we are at the start of the season. But I think it's promising. I think it's got a lot of promise here. Anything else that you wanna get off your chest before we hang up here?
Nope, I'm good.
All right. I hope you guys are good as well. I hope you guys check out The Gifted. I hope you guys enjoyed the podcast. We've got a ton of podcasts coming your way here on Post Show Recaps outside of the superhero space. Mr. Robot is indeed coming back very, very soon, premiering October 11th with its third season. So check out, be on the lookout for some podcasts from Antonio Mazzaro and I. We will also have tons of Walking Dead coverage for you all month long. Fear the Walking Dead is wrapping up. The main Walking Dead is ramping up. So we will have a lot of podcasts on that front. And of course, we are still doing our weekly Game of Thrones rewatch. Winter was here. We are through 4 episodes as of this podcast's recording. We are very much enjoying that, Rob and I, going back through the history of Westeros and talking about this show one episode at a time, 1 week at a time. And Rob also has launched his new podcast, his Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast with Akiva Whitaker, just after they have wrapped their epic full watch through of the Seinfeld. That is all wrapped up just in time for Curb to start up. So talk about serendipitous timing. Pretty cool stuff. So a lot going on here on Post Show Recaps. Make sure you are subscribed. PostShowRecaps.com/iTunes.